Our second case this morning is Bastian versus ENJ. Set for an hour, both parties ready? Just a couple of quick housekeeping matters. I don't think Mr. Epstein is here. I know you were. The timer after your 30 minutes goes up instead of just saying zero. It says zero and it goes up. We'll change it for the next arguments. Please tell us your name when you start your argument. And also, I'd like to mention to the petitioner that you have to keep track of your time. And lastly, what I said about iPads, we have our notes and cases on it, and we're not certain. So for that, we're ready to hear you. Petitioner?
Good morning, Justices. Robert Hutchinson on behalf of the petitioner Gary Bastian, and with me today is my co-counsel, Donald D'Antino. We would like to reserve 5 minutes at full rebuttal, unless I finish earlier, which hopefully I will, in which case we would reserve the balance of that time. By way of overview, we are here today because a majority of a panel of the Court of Appeals, sua sponte, decided to change altogether several standards regarding the resolution of the Rule 55C matter. And it did so without any real basis in law, we submit. And it did so by accepting what amounts to virtually no showing whatsoever by the moving party. And in so doing, it advanced several novel concepts. And with regard to the first issue, whether to what extent the three-prong tests apply in the face of perfunctory defenses, I would like to point out at the outset that the trial court was well aware of what it was doing. There was no mistake here. The trial court specifically stated it was resolving an entry of default matter. And in point of fact, we ourselves, in our response to the motion to set aside, pointed out or talked about Rule 55 and Rule 60 and argued then and there that the standards were substantially the same. The three-prong test, as you know, has to do with prejudice, excusable neglect, and meritorious defense. In the face of this default, the defendant proceeded to do nothing. It produced no affidavit. It adduced not one scintilla of evidence. It alleged not one single fact. It did nothing.
So what happened is that House counsel basically missed it, right?
I'm sorry?
House counsel basically missed the amended complaint. Is that what happened? Remind me what happened.
Well, yes. What happened was, there were statements by counsel that, and let's step back just for a second. Initially, EMJ's response was that there was some difficulty with the court registry. That's what happened. That was their initial motion. 2 days before the damage hearing on March 19th of 2009, which was 5 months after they got served, but only 2 days before the hearing, they filed a pleading saying our in-house counsel who does not perform tort litigation, did not forward the service of process. So at that point, they had changed their story, and they had ample time to present an affidavit to adduce evidence. We don't know whether that happened or not. We simply don't know. Why? Because we have no proof of it. We have no affidavit. We don't even know the name of the purported attorney. And so And in the face of that, what is the trial court presented with? It's presented with an evidentiary record, which on behalf of EMJ consists of nothing. And meanwhile, as the court knows from our briefs, there were prior admissions by EMJ's project manager stating that, yes, it flooded the parking lot in question in the face of icy conditions. So not only do we have no evidence, but we have an admission. And of course, we have no facts that they're alleging, and which raises the question, how could they allege facts?
We don't have a trial on the damages.
I'm sorry?
We don't have a trial on the damages. There's no damages ascertained, right?
Correct. Yes, Justice Holmes. So at that point, what does the trial judge do? The trial judge applied Colorado. And I'd like to, I mentioned sua sponte. I think it's worthy for me to draw to the court's attention the fact that in the court, in the proceeding below, EMJ never argued the standards that the trial court applied were the wrong standards. Never once. What he argued was the trial court misapplied the standards. But it was only when the Court of Appeals rendered this decision that now EMJ adopts the sort of jumps on the bandwagon and said, oh yes, by the way, these were the wrong standards. So we have a long line, as the court knows, of Colorado case law, beginning in 1958, continuing on up to 2001. The Weisbarn case, where this court has consistently looked at Rule 55 and Rule 60 and essentially has held that substantially the same standards apply. And that is what is so enigmatic about this Court of Appeals decision is that it's in the face of this Colorado law. And furthermore, what was even more enigmatic to us is that two of the authorities most prominently mentioned by the Court of Appeals here, Sim versus Mortensen and Morris Federal Practice, actually contradict what the majority held here. And as you know, both Sim and Morris Federal Practice do require a meritorious defense supported by fact allegations. So even very authority on which the Court of Appeals predicated this decision contradicts it. And it's in in that sense, we submit the Court of Appeals adopted certain aspects of the same that, but turned a blind eye to other aspects of the same.
Counsel, maybe I can just pick on this and stop you there and just ask you to articulate the test you think should apply here.
I think the test that should apply is that there must be a showing of excusable neglect on behalf of the moving party. I think that there should be a showing of a meritorious defense supported by facts and proof, which is to a clear, strong standard, as has been previously enunciated time and time again by this court, and that there should be likewise consideration as to prejudice regarding the parties.
Yeah, and maybe you can help me with that prejudice problem. What do you think that looks like?
In this case?
Yes.
We submit, Justice Ive, that there was prejudice here to Mr. Boston. Why? Because in proceeding below, there were arguments about multiple defendants, and moreover, there was decades-long precedent regarding Rule 55 and Rule 60 interpretations that we considered. And the upshot of it all is that we dismissed Lowell's as a co-defendant to obviate any question of prematurity, which EMJ had raised.
Yeah, I'm not really understanding that. Even as a matter of just strategy, why would you go ahead and do that?
Well, for the reason that there was every reason to believe that we would, that, I mean, first of all, this is, this sort of thing had been done before. I mean, this wasn't the first go around. I mean, in Kenter versus Hurd, exactly this kind of thing was done, where a plaintiff dismissed out co-defense in view of a prematurity argument.
I don't understand that. I mean, it sounds like a gotcha argument. I got a guy in default, I don't need the other one. You know, meanwhile, you're on clear notice that there can be default judgments set aside, right? I mean,
well,
what does prematurity mean? I didn't.
Well, it's prematurity in the sense that the argument was that there could be no final order when there is another co-defendant. I mean, that was essentially. And yeah, I mean, that's the situation that the Supreme Court addressed in Kenter versus Hurd.
But having made an election you didn't have to make, and then it's prejudice now because the court rules that you know, the merits are favored. I mean, you know, that is the law, right? The merits are favored.
That is one aspect of it, but as you know, that's not all the aspects.
Well, I understand.
No, I know you do.
But generally, you know, default right. Judgments are not favored.
Right, but remember, we in viewing this, we were looking at decades of precedent. We had no inclination that the Court of Appeals would sua sponte develop completely different standards, overturning essentially or contradicting precedent that goes back to at least 1958. So we thought we had a very solid basis for proceeding as we did. It was not a decision of the state in life.
Would you remind me, this was a number of days that we were talking about here, is that not right? Between the entry of a default and a response by the by opposing counsel?
Yes, it was. It was, I think it was 33 days.
Oh, it wasn't that long.
I think it was, yeah. And of course, that's exactly what I think the, I mean, that's what the Court of Appeals, this a majority of the panel of the Court of Appeals focused on in this case.
And when you were talking about prematurity there and a final order, would you just flesh that out a little for me again? So what was the importance of you dismissing the other defendants?
It was so that there would be no issue of prematurity. By having only one defendant left, there would be no question that the ruling would be a final determination, a final order.
You weren't suggesting what ruling, and final in what sense? Do you mean with regard to entry of a judgment of default? Are you thinking that you would have to dismiss the other defendants to get a judgment entered?
Right. At the point at which the damage hearing is conducted, it would be final. There would be nothing left for the court to do. Their argument was, it cannot be final. Why? Because there is another co-defendant in the action.
Counsel, could I ask you a couple questions about the test and your view of our case law? Putting to one side Court of Appeals decisions, which we are not bound by,
right.
But just looking at our case law,
right.
We seem to have dropped all sorts of indications that the standards are substantially the same, that you would apply the 60B approach in a typical 55 context, but we don't seem to have any cases where we have actually applied that to a Rule 55 entry of default. And I'm wondering, do you think that our case law basically at this point precludes us from taking that in any different direction? Or could we at this juncture take a look at Rule 55 and say, well, the phrase good cause means something a little bit different than the phrase excusable neglect?
To answer your question, I think I didn't take it as a whole, the case law does preclude that, but more specifically to your question, I think this court did address the issue fairly squarely in some order. As you remember, what happened there was, I think it was on May 11th, there was an entry of default. And then later on in October, there was an entry of judgment. And the Supreme Court in the summer stated that the entry addressed specifically both the entry of default under Rule 55C and the entry of judgment under Rule 60B.
And so in your view, having thus equated it, the Court of Appeals, well, let me ask you a different question. The Court of Appeals in Singh seems to think, okay, you take the Rule 60B standards, but you apply them in a little bit more lenient fashion when we're talking about a Rule 55 context. Is there any indication that our court, this court, has adopted such a view? Or is it simply an absolute straight application of the 60B standards in the 55 context? Is there any distinction at all?
I think it's a little both. This court has, I think, pretty much said straight up it's the same standard. However, I think it has in passing said, yes, one can be more flexibly applied. But on this point, I think there's something crucial here. Application of a more flexible standard does not mean no standard, does not mean no showing, and that's what we have here.
Counsel, so I just take it, you're saying no matter what standard or how we articulate it, this case fails to meet it? Is that? You're essentially arguing that it doesn't really, the fine-tuning of the standard doesn't really matter in this instance,
yes.
Because there is no affidavit.
Yes, Justice. That's exactly what I'm saying. And the...
But aren't you also saying that the Court of Appeals decision here modified the standard in a way that set the burden?
Well, I think it totally changed it. I think it completely changed it. It changed it. I think it essentially obviated the requirement of a meritorious defense supported by facts and supported by proof. I think it emasculated really the requirement regarding excusable neglect. I think it put forth a standard so watered down that unless you actually intentionally decided not to answer it, a complaint, that...
I guess the reason I asked my question, which is a little bit distinct from what Justice I was asking, is looking back at what the trial court did here, we need to think about, the Court of Appeals seems to be saying that the trial court applied the wrong standard.
Right.
And that was the error. If in fact the standards are the same and the trial court applied a 60B standard, then there arguably was no error. I'm just wondering, what is your view of how the trial court handled this? Are you saying that the 60B standard applies directly, the trial court applied a 60B standard, there was simply no error? Or are you saying that even if this court is to view the 55 context somehow a little bit more leniently, no matter where we set that bar, it wasn't met here? I'm just trying to understand the difference between...
I'm saying both.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely both.
Let's take your point that you should win in any case. But obviously one of the reasons we wanted to take this case was because of the question of how deferential a standard should be applied. And I take it that's because of the Court of Appeals' firm distinction, looking at some federal cases, between the good cause of 55C and the standards for a 60B. Whether you should win or not, for our purposes, I think Justice Marcus was asking about how firmly we had already committed ourselves on whether there's any difference between 55 and 60B. But in addition to that, would you address the merits, the policy merits, and also the words of the two rules? Should we change at this point? What's the benefit of distinguishing 55 from 60?
I don't think you should change a thing. This court has held that there's a three-pronged test, and it's a balancing test, and moreover, that the one factor informs the others. I think that's a very wise kind of an approach, and yes, it could be applied maybe more flexibly in a Rule 55C, but that's altogether, and I think that's a lot more enlightened than some of these federal rules. I think that the chief deficiency of some of the federal decisions, as we discussed in the briefs, is that none of the federal rules, or say it a little differently, all the federal decisions still require a meritorious defense and supported by facts. I mean, and EMJ cites the Second Circuit. As you pointed out, the Second Circuit doesn't even hold that way anymore. I mean, there's virtually no federal law or Colorado case law that would support a view of disbanding with a meritorious defense. Now, arguably, the Fifth Circuit does not say you must consider all three prongs. However, they still look at meritorious defense. So, to answer your question, I think that this court is exactly where it should be right now. And which kind of touches on the second part of why we're here today, and that is this idea of what should it be, clear abuse of discretion versus slight abuse of discretion. This is why I think it's such a good rule, the one we have now, is because we don't in Colorado micromanage the trial courts. And we believe that the appellate courts generally, and this court in particular, has quite enough to do already without tasking itself with doing that, without jumping in and finding, getting into the fact-finding business, which, as the court knows, it's loath to do unless its findings are against the clear weight of the evidence. And we know that didn't happen here. And on a policy matter, I think there are several things wrong with the policy as enunciated by the majority. And remember, Judge Roy attempted to postulate this same format or body of principles in the Sim case, and Judge Davidson, writing for the majority, rejected that. And one problem that comes to mind immediately is this idea that insurance defense counsel should be accorded special treatment. Because they might find it difficult to marshal facts in order to file an answer. I mean,
that really almost doesn't meet the straight face test, because we have all kinds of things about jurisdictional deadlines and filing deadlines, and just a mistake or negligence even is not an excuse, right? I mean,
right. It's not.
I mean, this guy's a counsel. He's supposed to manage litigation.
Right. Right.
So they hire an unqualified attorney to do this. I mean, that's their problem, isn't it?
It is. We couldn't keep a straight face when we read the argument.
I mean, and apparently it's not even asserted in the form of any evidentiary.
No.
Offer.
No, not none whatsoever, Justice Hobbs.
Yeah.
None. No, so there's that for a public policy problem. This idea that one should disregard Rule 11, one of my favorite, or one that's notable, is the idea that one should substitute the taking of evidence for the statements of counsel. We're unaware of that's ever happened. I mean, that is yet again another novel idea postulated by the majority below. At the end of the day, too, as a matter of public policy, what is the point of proceeding without a meritorious defense? I mean, courts, as you are acutely aware, sit to hear justiciable controversies. That's a core legal precept. But if you don't have a meritorious defense, you don't have that. So what's the point? Well, the only point that we've been able to think of is delay. delay and delay. There is no point.
Well, isn't the point of this appeal really whether the Court of Appeals should have substituted its discretion for the trial court's discretion?
I think that's a key point.
And if that's the point, then what we need to do is figure out what the bounds of its discretion, the trial court's discretion, are and what the nature of the review is. And you're saying that the discretion afforded the judge here is not that great. In other words, they can't say, well, as a matter of public policy, I think we really ought to try these cases. That's a better thing than any defaults. The rule says, no, if there's a default, there have to be these three things, and if you don't have these three things, then you don't want the default judgment. That's really your position.
I think our position is the trial court has a lot of discretion, but its discretion is
within... It's not unbounded discretion.
Right, it's within the framework.
And the Court of Appeals seems to be taking the position that they abused their discretion by overanalyzing the rule almost. They seem to be suggesting that the trial court read too strictly the rule of civil procedure.
I think that's right.
So how do we resolve that, since we're dealing with discretion? And the rule really just speaks for itself.
Well, I think there are a couple of things here. One is, if you are to decide that the three-prong standard remains intact, then I'm not sure you even have to reach the question of discretion. But assuming you do reach the question of discretion, you know, the traditional standard has been clear abuse of discretion. And what the Court of Appeals here is trying to do is impose slight abuse of discretion, and which to me is, or to us, is tantamount to saying you really have no discretion.
Well, I did notice in the Court of Appeals decision, for example, talking about whether or not there's a meritorious defense, that they use kind of loose language saying, well, they're sort of weak in this area, but in any event, we're not going to worry about that too much because we don't think it's that important of a factor, or something. I'm paraphrasing extraordinarily loosely, but that's in essence what they're saying.
It is.
But they didn't say that there was no defense proffered at all.
They did not say that. However, the entire weight of Colorado case law, virtually the entire weight of federal Morris federal practice, all say the same thing, and that is a meritorious defense must be supported by facts. And as you know, in Colorado, it's got to be done by a high burden of proof.
Or at least some evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just a default. This isn't a default judgment.
Right, correct.
So we're kind of one down the wrong, if you will.
Right.
And really, the policy is to try to get people to be able to try their cases on the merits.
Justice Rice, it is, however, there's as you know, the countervailing policy as enunciated by this court in Goodman, that it's not to litigate meritless defenses. And in fact, the court in Goodman said we find it difficult to imagine a case that should proceed absent a meritorious defense.
But it's hard to determine whether you're litigating a case with a meritless defense in the context of a default proceeding. I mean, that's all. I always found that kind of tough when I was a trial judge. Just because, you know, what was the nature of the evidence that was going to come in and that you would look at to decide? I mean, you're really not having a mini case to decide whether you lift the default and have a real case. So that's a hard kind of a area of discretion for a trial judge to exercise. Now, the trial judge did exercise it here, and you say that it's inappropriate for the Court of Appeals, I guess, to see that as an improper use of discretion. And that's your argument.
Right.
They're just tilting it. They're just tilting. They're just looking at the facts, what happened at the trial level, a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think the Court of Appeals here applies entirely different standards.
Okay.
May I just follow up? Your strong emphasis on the question of the meritorious defense makes me wonder, are you understanding our balancing test
yes.
to mean there has to be something shown on each of the three prongs, or would a decision of the judge be justifiable? Would it be within his discretion to make a decision based on any one of the three?
Well, Justice Coates, as you know, this court has repeatedly held that absent any one of the three prongs is sufficient to deny a motion in this kind of a context.
And would it be sufficient to grant a motion?
On any one? No. No, it would not. Not as we understand.
And so simply because with regard to the third prong and the balance of equities of the parties, if the shortness of time and the lack of detrimental reliance by the moving party, by the non-moving party, were completely absent, or where the time was so short, you don't think that would be a basis for deciding that the motion should have been granted?
No.
And that a judge would have abused his discretion by not granting it?
No, not at all. No. We strongly believe that, as do virtually all the authorities in Colorado and federally, that there has to be a meritorious defense supported by facts, and without which there's no point proceeding.
So in other words, the movement needs to show all three, needs to show excusable neglect, or that the neglect was excusable, needs to show a meritorious defense, and needs to show that in the absence, basically, of prejudice.
Yes.
And if they fall short on any of those three, you're saying that the default may be denied.
May be denied, yes.
Does the motion set it aside, may be denied?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson.
Thank you.
Mr. Epstein?
And please the court, counsel, Alan Epstein representing EMJ Corporation. The issue framed by this court is whether the Court of Appeals erred in holding that the trial court abused its discretion in holding that a defaulting party did not demonstrate excusable neglect under Rule 60B. And the defaulting party raised only perfunctory defenses. I'd rather be answering a different question or a question framed differently, but my answer is the Court of Appeals did not err. I'd like to first try to clarify what happened with respect to the dismissal of the co-defendant Lowe's. In the opening brief, in my opening brief in the Court of Appeals, my first argument was that because Lowe's liability had not been determined, there was no final judgment, and only after relying on federal law, there was really no Colorado case law directly on point, but relying on federal law addressing that question, we argued that the Court of Appeals had to reverse because Lowe's liability had not been determined. Subsequent to the answer briefing filed by the plaintiff dismissed Lowe's as a party defendant, and then plaintiff's answer brief went directly to the default issue. And then in our reply brief, I conceded that the finality issue was now moot since Lowe's was no longer a party. Plaintiff then argued in oral argument that the prejudice to the prejudice of the third prong of the test was that they had dismissed Lowe's. But they didn't have to dismiss Lowe's. That was self-induced prejudice. And for that proposition, I would refer the court to the case of Johnson versus Dayton cited in EMJ's answer brief. So there's no prejudice. The only prejudice in this case was going to be trying the case on the merits, since plaintiff did not demonstrate that there was prejudice in the form of lost evidence due to the passage of time, since very little time had passed. This court has held in several cases that the good cause requirement for setting aside a default under Rule 55C and the excusable neglect requirement for setting aside a default judgment under Rule 60B are sufficiently analogous to justify application of the same standards to each motion. but all of these cases arose in the context of default judgment, cases such as Buckmiller v. Safeway and Sumler v. District Court. The procedural posture of the case was reviewing default judgment, not default. The reason is obvious. Default is an interlocutory order. The only reason that it came up on appeal in this case and in Singh was that the trial court had been improperly treated what was a default as a default judgment, because in both Singh and in this case, damages had not yet been determined at the time that the trial judge entered default judgment. So this court has not addressed the issue that Justice Marquez was inquiring about earlier, and that's why it just doesn't come up. And in Singh, the Court of Appeals recognized that the entry of default...
Mr. Afton, could you... I understand if you incorporate the federal willfulness requirement, you have an argument for excusable neglect, but under our case law, I understand the procedural point you're making, you're absolutely right. What are you going to do with the factual findings by Judge King about there was no excusable neglect under our case law? Putting aside the nicer question of what standard is more rigorous and all that.
What happened was that the first response of EMJ was that not that the summons and complaint was ignored by staff counsel, but it was EMJ's in-house counsel, and they didn't recognize the importance of it. Did the summons and complaint say an answer had to be filed within 21 days or 30 days, whatever it was? Of course it did. But our argument is that that is sufficient good cause if you're analyzing this case under the good cause test of Rule 5.
Okay, I got it. Why?
Because of the federal cases which say that when the court's looking at a default as opposed to default judgment, it is excusable if it is not willful or gross negligence.
So you want us to incorporate in Rule 55 willfulness standard, right?
Yes.
Why?
Because it is more appropriate to apply a more lenient test to a default than a default judgment.
Well, that's absolutely right. I'm sure I don't think anyone would disagree with that. But there's a big difference between talking about something as being willful and something as not excusable. That to me requires a big culpable amount to me. That's significant.
I'm sorry.
I think the willfulness part is a big piece, really.
It is, and defendant is urging this court to adopt that test.
We've never had that test. You would agree with that, right?
I'm sorry?
We've never had that test.
You have never had that
whether
test.
Whether we call it excusable neglect or good cause, we've never interpreted a rule to have this willful intent element.
No.
You don't need us to adopt that test in order to win, do you?
No.
Okay, so why are you asking us to do that? Just because this is an opportunity?
Yes, the court has never had the opportunity today to address the issue that was addressed in Singh and that has been addressed in the federal cases that we rely upon. And it appears that the majority of federal cases addressing that first problem of the test require willfulness or gross negligence, which doesn't mean good cause or excusable neglect, but that's how it's been interpreted.
Please go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, we seem to be taking it sort of for granted, but as well, there's clearly a difference between default and a default judgment in that time period. Why would you articulate what that difference goes to? Why there should be a more lenient standard? And let me tell you what I'm sort of getting at here is it seems on its face, the only real difference seems to be, or it's that's readily apparent to me, is that because of the shortness of time, because of the difference between those two events, there's probably going to be less, it's going to be less likely that the positions of the parties have changed radically or one has been prejudiced as a result of relying on, to its detriment, on the behavior of the other. What do you see as the difference and why we should follow something like what some of the federal courts have done to have a different standard for just the default?
Because the default judgment is a final judgment and should be accorded the integrity that a final judgment is accorded. A default is an interlocutory order that is a ministerial act performed by the court clerk and shouldn't be given the same deference as a final judgment. Well, and because of what Your Honor just articulated, is that the amount of time that has passed is not likely to have incurred prejudice by the opposing party.
And in our prior cases, haven't we sort of dealt with that in the third prong of our test?
Yes. In the equitable consideration, whether the other party is prejudiced, and that typically involves a determination of whether sufficient time has passed that evidence has been lost.
And so I guess where I'm kind of trying to go on that is, so why isn't our test, as we've articulated it up to this point, just as good? Why doesn't it accomplish everything from a policy point of view anyway that we would be accomplishing by shifting and having a different standard for only a default?
Well, the test doesn't necessarily have to be different in terms of how it's articulated, but we would argue that it should be more leniently applied, and that's how the federal cases have interpreted. They apply the same test, but they apply it more leniently, and that was what was done in Sim. So the test need not be changed in terms of how it's articulated by the court, but we would urge the court to adopt the concept that the test should be applied more leniently when it is a default, not a default judgment. And it's a directive to trial courts, because again, appellate courts don't deal with the issue unless the case comes up because a default judgment was incorrectly entered rather than a default.
When with regard to the first prong of the sort of federal standard, then, so are you saying basically that we should just, that it's permissible to understand the term excusable neglect to mean willful?
I don't know how you do that without saying that the court is going to modify the first prong of the test to mean willfulness rather than excusable neglect, because excusable neglect is necessarily a higher standard.
Right. So you are asking us to change the standard with regard to all three prongs, and I take it that means you think that the way we had articulated our third prong before really doesn't solve the problem.
Yes, I think that what the majority opinion in Singh said, and what the majority opinion in this case said, is correct. That the first prong of this should be analyzed under the term good cause, not excusable neglect, because excusable neglect is a Rule 60B concept, not a Rule 55C concept, and. The two have been morphed because of the Supreme Court case law saying, which says that they're sufficiently analogous to treat them the same, even though the court has never actually treated a default entry at all. It's only treated default judgment cases.
So let me get this straight now. Counsel is sitting at his or her desk, in-house counsel, gets a summons and complaint, and put it aside. This is not a case of, you know, the counsel was on vacation or it got mixed up in the mail or anything else. I mean, the allegation is counsel was fully aware and didn't respond.
It wasn't House Counsel as opposed to Defense Counsel?
Yeah, the insurance.
It wasn't the insurance. In this case, it wasn't the insurance counsel. It was
corporation
corporate counsel.
But it's still a lawyer.
Who's still a lawyer.
Okay. Thank you for saying that.
And then it was transmitted, and I don't know exactly what the circumstances were. Then it was transmitted from corporate counsel to House counsel, who immediately tried to file an answer. And it was within a quick duration of time. But couldn't do it for another, couldn't get it accomplished for another 5 days because ENJ was not registered on LexisNexis, and I don't know how that works. But anyway, another five days elapsed.
So, Mr. Epstein, how do we, if we take findings of fact that Judge King made and agree with you that he used the wrong standard, as you've argued, but how does that establish an abuse of discretion with respect to good cause? I mean, what are the facts that, how do we look at that?
Well,
I mean, it's true he used the wrong standard, but he still made factual findings.
There are a number of federal cases that are cited in our answer brief in which, under very similar circumstances, the appellate court found an abuse of discretion, and the meritorious defense element was no different than in this case. An answer was filed, and a boilerplate or perfunctory meritorious defense was asserted, and the appellate courts in those cases said, well, it's not a lot, but it's enough to meet the meritorious defense standard. And I also cited cases in which the motion to set aside the default was not accompanied by affidavit. And the rule doesn't require that it be accompanied by affidavit. It's case law interpreting the rule recite factual circumstances of those cases in which an affidavit was filed. But I don't believe there's any case that says that you absolutely have to file an affidavit. And I think the Court of Appeals was correct that the attorney who attested to what happened, or the allegation that was advanced in the answer, was advanced under Rule 11, and there's no reason to believe that attorney would have been more truthful had an affidavit accompanied the motion. He was still constrained by Rule 11.
Can I go back to the difference between default and judgment of default just for a second? What has to happen between entry of a default and entry of a judgment of default?
There has to be a motion to enter a default. The default is entered usually by the clerk. Then the plaintiff asks to have a damages hearing, and then there's a damages hearing, and still no entry by a defense counsel. Damages are determined. Now you have a final judgment. That's a default judgment. What happened in this case was a motion for default judgment was made, which should have been characterized as a motion for default. Then an answer was interposed, but everybody treated it as a motion for default judgment. The trial court denied the motion to set aside the default judgment, then had a damages hearing, and entered what then became a default judgment, a final default judgment.
And so is there something about having to have a damages hearing that would cause us to feel that the standard of neglect or culpability on the part of counsel for not responding, not having an answer, should be different? I guess what I'm trying to get at is why do we look to excusable neglect for entry of once we've had an entry of a judgment, but we should have to look to willful behavior for only entry of a default? Is there something about having to hold a damages hearing in between that would cause us to feel that the attorney's behavior in the first, with regard to only entry of a default, should have to be a greater culpability?
I think because there should be a higher standard imposed, because after the damages hearing has been conducted and a party still has not, the defense still has not interposed a defense, you now have a final judgment. So the conduct, if you will, has necessarily become more culpable.
Well, there's a difference in the procedures. Usually the default is entered by the clerk, and you have a formal evidentiary hearing, right, where evidence has to be presented and so forth.
Right.
So it's not just a passage of time, but it's an adjudication.
And, yes. it's usually very awkward. I mean, these hearings where you have one attorney in here proving out damages, and the judge on the motion for entry of default damages. I mean, that really is a very significant sort of hearing, because you can only have a real live person in there testifying.
Right.
And still absent a defense.
Right. And in most cases, well, it should be in all cases, when that happens, the defendant has still not interposed the defense, and there's no attorney there. That didn't happen in this case. There was an attorney there for damages hearing.
Counsel, if I could take you back to an earlier point, you had seemed to indicate that our case law does, in fact, equate the two, that the 60B standards apply in the Rule 55 context. You also then seem to be asking us to apply those standards in a more lenient fashion in the Rule 55 context. And then you also seem to be saying that more lenient version ought to be tethered to the phrase good cause. I'm wondering if really what you're just asking us to do is develop a different standard for Rule 55, one that is tethered to the phrase good cause. Is that what you're really asking us to do? And if not, what does it look like? What do the three prongs under 60B look like when applied more leniently? How is excusable neglect look different? How does a meritorious defense look different?
Well, I think if you look at Judge Roy's concurring opinion in Singh, he explains how that should be done. How he said something about, or maybe in this case, he said something about putting the head of the 60B camel in Rule 55C, and he would endorse throwing out the Rule 60B analysis entirely and instead focusing on the good cause language of Rule 55C.
And is that what you would ask us to do here?
Yes.
Given that we haven't actually applied the 60B standards in a true 55 context, and we're therefore not,
yes,
therefore have that opportunity to do so here? Is that your argument?
I am. And many of the federal cases that we rely on explicitly articulate that when we are dealing with Rule 55C, it's a different standard. They're not the same, and the reason is that one is an interlocutory ministerial act, and the other is a final judgment. But I can't off the top of my head think of what they are, but these cases articulate that what may not constitute excusable neglect under Rule 60B may constitute excusable neglect under Rule 55C. Those are in our answer brief, and those cases explicitly say that.
They're really all based on the policy, aren't they, really? That resolution of disputes is to be resolved on the basis of merits and in favor of the movement. I mean, that's really the policy that underlines all this stuff.
And I think that should be the overarching policy in determining the issue in this case.
But in this case, you were able to have the arguments on damages, right, and produce evidence?
Well, there was a damages hearing, but the ship had sailed because the judge had denied the motion for to set aside the default judgment.
Well, I'm saying, so liability is conceded, right? But you had a full opportunity on what the damages were, right?
I didn't do it, but tell me
what happened. The allegation here on the in your other counsel's brief, your opponent, is that that there was a full opportunity to present evidence on damages, and EMJ didn't produce anything.
There was, counsel may be right. I know there was an attorney for EMJ at that hearing, but it wasn't. But there hadn't obviously been the discovery and preparation for cross-examination of witnesses that there would have been had had the default been set aside, because there was no opportunity to do any of that. So yes, there was a hearing, but was there the opportunity to mount a defense in the same way that there would have been in a real trial? No.
You didn't do any discovery. There wouldn't have been an opportunity to do any discovery or have any kind of deposition of expert witnesses or going to testify or that kind of thing when you were coming in, I suppose, only on a default hearing, the default judgment hearing.
Correct.
I don't understand. Like, those are kind of pro forma where somebody just comes in and plaintiff says, you know, I win this case, and here's my testimony of what I think it's worth. And I guess I can remember one or two where there's been a defense counsel in there, and those very, very odd situations yours.
But I never went through that, but it seems to me that in this case, there was an opportunity for counsel to ask for continuance to do discovery. The damages hearing hadn't happened.
I don't think there was an opportunity to move for a continuance since the default judgment had already been entered. And if the default judgment's entered, you don't have a procedural opportunity to move for a continuance or ask for discovery.
Well, as you've already pointed out, the default judgment hadn't been entered. It was a default.
It was a default, but it was not treated as a default. Everybody, the parties and the trial court treated it as a default judgment, not a default. It was, what happened was, and it was argued that way in the Court of Appeals up until the Friday before oral argument on the following Tuesday, because Monday was Labor Day, and the parties were given a directive by the Court of Appeals which said, please be prepared to argue this case in light of Singh v. Mortensen, which nobody had cited. We read Singh, and the obvious import was, this was not a default judgment. It was a default. So it was only on the eve of oral argument in the Court of Appeals that anybody realized, oops, this should not have been a default judgment. It was only a default. And then the opinion came out and explained that this was improperly moved as a default judgment and entered as a default judgment.
I think maybe something that might help me understand it is there's a difference between trying to set aside a default and then you are trying to set aside a default judgment, right?
I'm sorry.
Those are two separate things. You're trying to set aside. It really, those are two. And the reason that kind of difference is important is because one is just, as the chief says, a ministerial act, and one is actually a judgment.
Correct.
And so we have to treat those things as kind of different. But you do have an opportunity. For example, you all, I suppose, could have come in and after the court had said that it wouldn't have made sense in this particular case, but it's theoretically possible that after the default judgment had been entered, you could have sought to set it aside, right?
Yeah.
And you didn't choose to do that, but you could have done that. I've seen that done a number of times.
Well,
a year later, somebody will come in and say, hey, wait a second, I was in Brazil. I never got this stuff. I want to set aside this default judgment. It all happened without me being here. And then you would look at it very, very strictly, as opposed to your kind of a situation where you say, you know, in-house counsel screwed up, I'm really sorry, mistakes happen, can we have a trial on the merits? And that's your situation, right? And that's why the rules are different. We have two different ways of looking at this problem.
Yes, that's what our argument is. There is yet no Supreme Court case saying that. The only case, the only appellate decision in Colorado talking about it is Singh. Again, because it just doesn't come up.
Okay, thank you.
Well, counsel, let me just pick up on your argument that the Court of Appeals kind of sui sponte injected this. I guess your argument is that the Court of Appeals interjected it, but they correctly decided the issue?
Yes. I'm reading tea leaves, but the reason that it came up this way was because Judge Roy was on the panel. Judge Roy saw that this was the same procedural posture that it was involved in Singh. He remembered that. He wrote the concurring opinion in Singh. And, he said, hold the phone. This should not have been a default judgment. It should have been only a default. And that's what the issue is that we should be addressing it.
Okay, but you had other arguments based on treating it as a default judgment in your appeal. In the Court of Appeals, yes. I'm just trying to get a sense of what did the Court of Appeals case look like before this issue was brought up?
The briefing all assumed the procedural context of default judgment. It was only the Friday before oral argument that the order came out saying, look at Singh v. Lee Mortensen and see if it has any impact on our decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. Mr. Hudson, you have half a minute.
Yeah, thank you. It's going to be quick. First of all, there was discovery in this case. Interrogatories were promulgated and they were answered. There was never a request to take a deposition. Certainly that could have been done. Secondly, this court did not treat this thing as a default judgment. Time and time again, I mean, from almost day one, we talked about the difference between 55C and 60. And the court, in the transcript, says that. I refuse to set aside the default. He says default judgment, and he says, excuse me, no, I refuse to set aside the default. This public policy on the merits, I think one of the things that makes this case egregious is that there was this admission. So it's not as if we're left guessing about who the responsible party is. We know. And finally, I think Justice Rice is exactly right. The Rule 60B motion could have been argued subsequent to the entry of a judgment, and it never happened. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for your briefs and your arguments. The case will be submitted on the briefs, and the court will take